Hi, this is Tom Brevoort, and you are listening to the Captain America Comic Fans Podcast.
Greetings, Cap fans, and welcome to episode 86 of the Captain America Comic Book Fans Podcast. I am your host, Rick Verbanis, and as always, I'm joined by the best gosh darn co-host out there, and that would be Mr. Bob Lucius. Hey, Bob. Clang, 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 clang.
I have no idea.
No? You don't know what that is?
No.
That's the sound of letting freedom ring.
Damn right.
That's right. And for those who haven't read Captain America Zero, that was from the first panel on page 4 of both Sam and Steve throwing their shields and taking out the Zolas.
There you go.
And we figured, what better reference should we do to start off the show? And for those who don't normally listen to this podcast, that's what I like to do. When I say hello to Bob, I like to do a different hello to him every episode. And I usually, if I'm, you know, doing well, I'll try to tie it in to this episode. And of course, tying in Captain America Zero to this episode makes sense because our guest today is the editor of the Captain America franchise. And that would be Miss Alana Smith.
Damn straight. About time.
I know. We've been excited to get her on the show for quite some time. And so we'll be talking with her shortly. But this is exciting times, Bob, right? I mean, we've been waiting 9 months for the Captain America ongoing series to start back up again. And they launched it with a one shot number Zero. And then we have two new series coming out, right? We have the Sam Wilson series, which is Symbol of Truth. That just came out. So it's on the stands now if you want to check it out, and we highly recommend you do. And then Sentinel of Liberty, that's going to come out, mid-June, I want to say. And that one stars Steve Rogers. So we've got two new series. It's exciting times.
It is. You know, and Rick, we've talked to a few editors, right? I mean, a couple anyway, and we've talked extensively about Mark Gruenwald's run. And you interviewed Catherine Schuler Gruenwald. Mm-hmm. But in all those cases, this was like folks that have either, you know, they'd been in the trenches a long time and they were done their run. But we're talking to Alana Smith, and she's really at the beginning of her run as the editor of the Cap series. So it's a great opportunity for us to see where this might go.
Yeah. We can't wait to get into some of those questions. We also have some of our listeners who have either emailed in or called in with some of their questions too. And you may wonder, well, how do I get to do that? Well, if you're a patron of the podcast and in our Facebook group, we will actually email you ahead of time, advance notice, who our next guest is going to be and give you an opportunity to submit a question. And how do you become a patron, you may ask?
How do you become a patron?
Well, that's pretty easy, Bob. You could just go to our show notes for any podcast you're listening in, and there's a link on there to donate, and or you can just go to our website, which is CaptainAmericaComicBookFans.com, and there is a link on there as well. And not only do you get to know in advance and ask cool questions, we have some cool premiums to give away as well, like a Captain America, What Would Cap Do Challenge coin, and a couple other fun things. Like you get automatically submitted into our contests. You get your pre-approved for our Facebook group. So lots of cool premiums for being a member and supporting this show. So we really do appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. We most certainly do.
And that allows us to continue to put out new shows every Wednesday, like New Comic Day, So any of your favorite podcast providers, you will get a new show every Wednesday. And then the first Wednesday of the month is typically our guest. And so today we've got, as we mentioned, Alana Smith. So Bob, without further ado, let's get to our guest.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Our next guest, Alana Smith, is editor working on such titles as Avengers, Miss Marvel, Iron Man, Fantastic Four, and of course, the two new Cap series, Symbol of Truth and Sentinel of Liberty. She has certainly paid her dues, having worked on over 1,000 issues while at Marvel, working closely with executive editor Tom Brevoort for over 7 years. In fact, it was in episode 35 that Tom announced on this show.
Can't say you can have this quasi-exclusive, nobody will care information. I can say that my last issue as editor, direct editor of Captain America, will be 30.
Oh,
so I will be done. It'll still be in my Avengers area. I will still be overseeing it, but my associate editor, Alana Smith, who's been the associate and the assistant editor on Cap for about 5 years now, will be taking over as the editor.
So since then, we have been itching to have her on to wrap Cap with us. Alana, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about Captain America.
Well, you found your people on this show.
I'm glad.
So, you obviously started out probably with an interest in comics, right? As a mm-hmm. fan reading and mm-hmm. so forth. So at what point did comic books become important in your life?
So I kind of came into comics through manga, which I think a lot of people in my like age bracket kind of did. And I had a friend group that, you know, shared a bunch of manga back and forth and kind of would just pass whatever new thing we found at like Walden Books or Borders. And then in that group of friends, I had a friend who specifically was very into Marvel books. And I think, at one point they passed me a copy of Runaways and like, that was it. So, you know, I read a ton of Runaways. And even before that, like I was primed to be interested in it because I got, I about a billion times played the Spider-Man Activision PC game, which got me super, super into Spider-Man. I think there was just a long period of my like younger life where I didn't fully realize that there were people other than Spider-Man that I could be interested in. So I would read like every comic I could find in the library, every comics that my friends passed me. And then just, you know, gradually I realized that it was a medium I really loved with characters I really loved. And I kind of started toying with making my own comics, like mostly kind of, goofy fan comics on like DeviantArt back in the day. And then another fan comic later on, and also a weekly comic strip for my college newspaper. So like, it's always been a medium I really, really enjoy. I think it just, you know, it's got a way of evoking emotion in a way that, is unique to it specifically. And so, yeah, it was just kind of a long journey of falling in love with many different kinds of comics.
Yeah. I love the fact that you mentioned that, you know, it's a unique medium mm-hmm. with the, that emotional side, because, yeah. you know, when Tom was on, he referenced a study. You probably have heard him talk about this, where there was a study done, maybe it was the late 80s, that how comic books basically talk to both sides of your brain, unlike most mediums. Yeah. You know, he said like the closest thing you could come to is like watching a movie with subtitles, but really that really isn't it. Right. So,
right.
So to your point, you know, it does, it has that visual, it has the, you know, the written word, and then it has that emotional as well. So when, I mean, outside of Spider-Man, you know, playing on the video game and Runaways was your gateway drug, so to speak, for Marvel Comics, were there any characters or stories that just really resonated with you and kind of pulled you in to that universe?
Yeah, I mean, the first run that I bought all the way through was Cable and Deadpool. It was just, again, it was one of those weird things where I kind of came in through the video games. I played Marvel Ultimate Alliance, and that's where I learned about Deadpool as a character. And I was like, who is this? Like, I need to read more, like, immediately. So I went out and found, like, every trade I could find, which was a little hard at the time because Deadpool was not a popular character in that time period. So you kind of had to look around to find, like, all these books that weren't currently in print. Now they've been reprinted to death, but back then that was not the case. So, you know, I really, really love those characters. Like I'm a sucker for fourth wall breaking stuff. So that was kind of my into Deadpool. And then like with Cable and Deadpool specifically, like it's just these two characters who are so extremely different, who like nonetheless have this like very strange and, you know, intriguing bond with each other where, you know, I think it's easy to write Cable as like always kind of annoyed by Deadpool's antics, but the thing I like about that initial series was that like he's kind of charmed by it too, like they kind of get each other in a way that you wouldn't expect, and there's a lot of real emotional gut punches throughout that run, and so I really enjoyed it, and it also touched on a bunch of larger Marvel Universe stuff that I hadn't really experienced yet, so I kind of got to learn about other things throughout that series as it went. So that was a very big one for me.
Yeah, it's interesting you said about Cable, Deadpool, and Runaways. I mean, it sounds about the time I used to own a comic book store back during that time when those were coming out, and I can just see you now coming in to the store and perusing. I mean, that was, you know, that was a fun time. I mean, Marvel had a lot out there. Yeah. They were competing, you know, to own space on the wall. Not that they've stopped, but there was a lot of good stuff coming out during that time.
Yeah, I got super into the Ultimate line too. I think a little before that because it was, you know, it was designed to be a jumping on point for people who were my age, and that's exactly how it worked for me. Like, I was like, I can start from one, and I know everything. So I bought a lot of Ultimate X-Men and read a lot of Ultimate Spider-Man in addition to, you know, main universe Spider-Man. So it was a fun time to be starting reading comics. I think there were a lot of really cool reach out efforts around that time that worked well. Like, I have a lot of colleagues who say their entry point was Runaways. There's just so many who are like, that was the first thing.
So Alana, you graduated from the State University of New York at Geneseo, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so tell us, how did you make that jump? How did you get from A to B and end up as an editor at Marvel?
So I majored in creative writing and minored in studio art, thinking like that's comicsy. And I did like specifically go with the aim of I would like to edit comics at Marvel Comics, which was aiming pretty high, but I was very ambitious. So I think even before I graduated, I was sending out job applications, and one of the things I sent out was just a like the most personalized, like as charming as I could be, like cover letter to an assistant editor position at Marvel. And I actually got through like the second part of the process, like not long after that, which, you know, I was shocked by because I hadn't done anything, like I just graduated, but I didn't get the job. And then I think they called me back like 2 years later and actually brought me in for an interview, actually with Nick Lowe in the Spider-Man office, but I didn't get the job. And so then like I was living in New York City at the time, and I kind of failed out of New York City and like moved back home. And of course, as soon as I moved back home, I got the interview that led to getting the job, and I had to pack up and go back to the city. So, you know, it was a long journey of, I wasn't super qualified when I first applied, but between each failed application, I was trying to like build my credits, build my knowledge of comics, like, you know, jumping around to different like internships and different like areas of publishing, and also some like film and TV stuff, and also some like SEO writing. So it's kind of just a matter of like how much, you know, how much can I make my resume look more appealing until it actually sticks this time. And the other thing was, one of the people in the hiring process left his phone number and email in one of the contacts. So I was like, well, he's never getting rid of me now. He's getting rid of me like every like 4 months. And so I'm very grateful to him that he wasn't annoyed by that and did keep bringing my name back up. So
wow, that's yeah. That's the power of persistence.
Yeah, I did my best. So it was, I was very, very determined to get in here.
I got to say, you know, when you went through your list of different things that you worked on, I had a Steve Rogers Avengers MCU moment. I got that reference because you said SEO writing. And I'm like, yes, I'm a marketing guy. I'm like, I understand that.
Yep. I wrote a lot of articles about dental implants. So I know a lot about dental implants that will never be useful to me. I hope, you know, if I keep all my teeth, but well, if I lose all my teeth, I'm prepared. I know what the process is.
You know the process. So I think a lot of folks who read comics, at least casually, right, they may not have any idea what an editor does, right? And we asked Tom this question, and I think it's fair to ask you as well. And I want to know, like, now that you've got all this time under your belt editing, is it what you thought it was?
I think weirdly, it's kind of what I hoped it was, but was afraid it wasn't. Like, I think I was very afraid that it wasn't going to be a very creative role, and it wasn't going to be a role where I got a lot of decision-making power. And like, I think that's weird for me to say in retrospect, because like who else would make the decisions? But like, you know, very, very quickly when I was hired as an assistant, like, you know, Tom actually took my input when I was suggesting artists and, you know, colorists and, you know, even like writer notes, you know, so I was allowed to have a lot of agency very quickly, which I think is a testament to Tom's managerial skills, though. Maybe don't tell him I said that, because he'll get weird. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot like the job itself. It's really like a lot of the putting people into positions to make a cool book. So it's, you know, like Tom always says, like most of the job is hiring the right artist and writer at the beginning. And I really do think that's true, because if you get the right combination, like a book can kind of just run itself and you don't have to do much. Like there are certain people who their scripts come in and you're just like, oh, they're good. Like I don't have to, they're fine. You know, it's a lot of that casting process at the beginning where you're looking at a character like Captain America and being like, who do I know that has a good Cap story in them? And then also, who do I know who would draw a really great Cap? And so it's a matter of trying to move those pieces into position. And then once they're in the position, trying to keep them on the track as long as you can. So making sure that deadlines are hit, making sure that scripts make sense, making sure that things are compelling enough in each issue to keep people coming back next month. You know, a note I give very often is this a strong enough cliffhanger? Like, you know, do people have reason to actually haul themselves back out to a comic book shop and get the next issue? So that's a big part of it. And it's also, I'm sure Tom said this too, there's a lot of psychology involved because you're working with a lot of different people at once. So you kind of have to learn people's patterns and, you know, what will get out of work out of a certain person versus what will get work out of a different person. And you also keep an eye out for them when, you know, if there's a collaborator clashing with another collaborator, you're the mediator and you have to kind of be like, to your corners, guys, we're gonna sort this out. So there's a lot of it that's just like, you know, it's like running a bunch of group projects at once, really, like, and trying to make sure none of them burn down. And I think that's that's kind of what I hoped the role would be, but again, I was afraid it would be more clerical and less creative. But I've gotten to be very creative in this role, and I'm very grateful for that.
Are you? Is there a temptation? I mean, I know if I was an editor, I'd be tempted all the time to have those little editor notes and panels, you know?
I think that's very true of a lot of editors. I tend to have a bit of a lighter hand on things usually. Like my preference is kind of the Tom method of, if I put the right people in the right position, I will be able to work a little less hard in theory, you know, so, and I just, you know, I have so much admiration for all of our creators that sometimes, you know, you have a note that you can kind of let go and be like, I have to trust that they know what they're doing this time.
Yeah.
So a lot of the job is figuring out like what's worth pushing back on and what isn't. So, yeah. Editing yourself, as it were. So, yeah.
Holding restraint, picking your battles.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big part of it as well.
So when Bob, when you mentioned editor's note, the first thing I thought of was the, what we see in the finished product, right?
Right.
The little things at the bottom of the panel.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I do. Sometimes writers add those in for you, actually. I always feel a little self-conscious about like putting my name in there, but sometimes writers in the scripts will be like, this note is from Alana. And I'm like, okay. So I don't do as many of those, but I usually, if there really needs to be one, I'll put it in, or if a writer suggested it, I'll let the writer do it. But yeah.
I think the old school readers love that sort of thing.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I will say we were covering the Captain America Iron Man miniseries, and I think it was issue one. Mm-hmm. And what was the name of the big villain, the big robot that lived on the island?
The Myrmidon?
Yes.
Or the Overseer. There were two.
Yeah, I think it was the Overseer.
Overseer.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Myrmidon was the physical one.
Overseer. Yes. Yeah. There was an Overseer. And they had an editor's note in one of the panels, and it had like, you know, last scene in Iron Man 37 or something like that. And which 37? Like, there's been so many different Iron Man series.
The original.
Right. Well, we both thought it was like the most recent or whatever. And I looked it up online. I was like, no, it is the original.
Yeah.
And wow, you know, kudos to the writer for going back and doing his due diligence. And,
yeah, that was a Derek Landy deep cut, which I really enjoyed. It's one of those things where like the volume system, like the volume one, volume two, is used a lot more externally than it is at Marvel internally. Like a lot of times we'll refer to the runs as like years they ran. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where it would be much easier if I could just point to like a universal volume, but sometimes that information like isn't as established internally as we would like it to be.
That's interesting.
So yeah,
because we were just having this conversation that for number zero, was it volume 9 or volume 10, and depending on where you go, like if it was marvel.fandom.com or whatever, you know, they might have it as volume 10, but somebody else may have it as volume 9. So it's interesting that internally you guys just refer to the years.
Yeah, it's definitely also tricky because it does make things hard to find in our archive. I think there are probably people at the company who have all that information. It's just a lot goes into like what counts and what doesn't. Like a lot went into producing those legacy numbers that are on some of the books now, and deciding like what counted toward the 700 issue, like legacy number count, and what didn't. So like there's, it should be very simple, and it's never very simple, basically.
Yeah. And we definitely want to get into the legacy numbering. That's a question I want to ask for you. But by the way, Bob and I totally agree as far as Derek Landy is concerned. Anytime he wants to do another miniseries, we love his writing.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And you know, the Falcon and Winter Soldier miniseries, that Madam Hydra that he created, character he created, is just so much fun.
She's great. I mean, if you want to know a behind the scenes tidbit, working with Derek was honestly kind of like a pipe dream for me. He was one of my absolute favorite authors when I was younger, like when I was, you know, a teenager getting his books out from the library, which were kind of hard to find because they didn't have a wide US release. He does this incredible, incredible YA series called Skullduggery Pleasant, which is still going. Like, I was reading these when I was in high school, and it is still going. So like, I think I had a feeling just from reading his books that I was like, I feel like this guy's into comics. I feel like I could get him to do something here and it would be really cool. And his dialogue was always amazing. And that's kind of one of the things you look at for in a prose writer, like, can they write people speaking to each other? And I don't even remember how I managed to get his contact info, but I think I just asked Tom, like, can I see if this guy would be into something? Cause I feel like he would be. And I just happened, you know, immediate enthusiastic yes from his camp of like, I definitely want to write comics. I want to write every
comic. Wow.
So okay. he's a huge comic book fan. He's a huge collector. And he's also just really lovely and delightful. So I was so pleased that I got to work with him, and I'm still like pinching myself a little bit. And it was funny. It was reciprocal because he was pinching himself that he got to write Marvel Comics. So we were both kind of like the whole time we were interacting. So I'm always down to work with Derek. I think he's an absolute delight.
Well, kudos to you for going out and bringing him in. I mean, that's a huge win for you. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. It's great to hear the positive feedback about it. Cause obviously he's one of my all time favorite writers. And it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I hope other people like him as much as I do.
Yeah. Now we had great fun. We need to see The Natural again.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Yeah. I really great wanted character. That Falcon and Winter Soldier series was so fun. I would have done like 1,000 issues of that if they had let me, but unfortunately it came to an end.
Well, let's get to Cap. Right. So, you know, we did have to wait 9 months between the last issue of the Coates series and then between Cap and Zero. So and of course we had the United States of Captain America miniseries, the Captain America Iron Man miniseries we just talked about. And it helped fill the void. And of course you were the editor for both of those. But what was the decision? Like why was there such a long wait between the ongoing series?
Yeah, so there were a number of different factors in this. It was kind of a complicated process, and I can't get into all of them, but I can get into the broad strokes. Like one of the main things was that Ta-Nehisi was able to wrap up his run a little faster than we thought. We weren't sure if he would want to go to 35 or stop it. I believe he stopped at 30. Yeah. And when we ended up stopping at 30, it was not his fault. Like, it was just the time for the story to be done. But we were caught a little flat-footed, like, because we hadn't thought that we needed to hit the ground running, and then suddenly it was like, oh, go. And it was like, okay, we gotta go. And so, you know, we started thinking what the next iteration of Cap would even look like, because Ta-Nehisi is very big, you know, very big footsteps to follow. So there was a lot of internal discussions about what we wanted the next iteration of Cap to look like. And we had kind of gone a ways down that path. And then it was decided, you know, to my great happiness, that we were going to do two books, because Sam was gaining such prominence in the MCU. It just felt right that, you know, he'd get his promotion again and become Cap, which I was very sad to see him lose the shield. So I was very happy at an opportunity to revisit Sam, because Sam was Cap when I started at Marvel. So he's kind of always been like Cap in my heart. And so that was great news, but it also required a lot of reshuffling in terms of what we were thinking about and what we were planning to do. And then a lot of it from that point was just a lot of people weighing in on, you know, the concepts and what we wanted to do, and a lot of waiting to hear back from people. And then it was even more like, well, what's a good launch month? Like, when will the book sell well? Like, when can we position it well? And then when artists were cast, it was like, when are they done with their previous assignments? When can they start the book? So it would be easier if there was like one specific reason why we waited that long, but really it was kind of just a perfect storm of a bunch of different elements. And I think before the Coates run ended, we had already been planning US of Cap just as a fun thing to do. And so that kind of became like something that we were gonna use to, you know, fill the space as we worked on another Cap series. And then, you know, Cap Iron Man was another one of those. Not that either of those were seat fillers. I think they're both delightful and great. But we wanted to make sure Cap was on the shelves in some form until we were ready to move on everything. And the upside of that is that on both of these books, we were able to work unusually far ahead. So Carmen Carnero is like already drawing issue 6. Like, wow, she's a beast. So, you know, I'm very excited because in theory, it means we get to keep a much more consistent art team on a book than we usually would, given the breakneck pace of publishing. And so, you know, it was kind of a blessing in disguise that we got nudged back so far, because I think it really gave us time to figure out what we wanted to do and try to get it as right as possible.
Well, we're very excited to see Sentinel of Liberty come out. So mm-hmm. right now, talking to you, issue 0 has come out. Mm-hmm. And then issue 1 of Symbol of Truth has come out. So we're very much looking forward to Sentinel of Liberty. So let's talk about 0, right? So mm-hmm. It came out not too long ago. And Bob and I both agree, and the you know, the people in the Facebook group, great story, amazing art. You know, and it was a launching pad, right, for this, yeah, for the two new ongoing series. Now, did Marvel feel there needed to be this issue 0 to kind of explain why two characters were Captain America at the same time, rather than just immediately go into the two series? Because it was hinted, you know, in the United States of Captain America. And so just curious, number one, you know, why was there a one shot? And number two, as far as number 0, we've never had a number 0 before for mm-hmm. Captain America. So that's kind of cool. And so just wanted to see, you know, why you decided to go with a 0 rather than just a one shot.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it was less about explaining why there were now two Caps and more about getting people on board with the idea that these two Caps are different and can coexist in a really fun and engaging way. Like part of our goal in that issue was to sell people on like the character chemistry and, you know, both like all the writers that are involved and just the idea that, like, I think people get tripped up sometimes on, like, you know, how can two people have this name at the same time? And I don't think that's as much of a logistical problem as people sometimes build it up to be in their heads. And that was kind of the goal of the issue, was to be like, yeah, these two guys are Captain America and it's fine. Like, and it's fun and it's great. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that was a big goal of it. And also, like, you know, it was a way to, like, I don't necessarily want people picking one book or the other. I want people hyped for both. So it was a way to, you know, kind of ensure that people who might have picked up one or the other, like basically giving them a case for, like, here's why both of the books will be exciting. Here's why both of them are like can't miss comics. So that was a big part of it. And also, honestly, like the writers just had a blast working together. So like that was a really fun element of it as well. Like it got them, it kind of forged the Cap like coalition team between the books, where they just have such mutual respect for each other and they're always hyping each other up, and it's really wonderful, like, to see them work together. So yeah.
And it did, it came out well. It was very fluid, you know, fun story. You know, of course you go classic villain with a mm-hmm. Zola, you can't go yeah. wrong there. And the art, absolutely amazing, right? Because
yeah, Mattia's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, pencil ink, color, all of it together was just stunning. So you mentioned, you know, Sam as Cap in the MCU. Mm-hmm. So people automatically kind of assume, okay, well, you know, we have to, it's kind of like life emulating art, right? It's well, we've got Sam in the MCU, we need to have Sam is in the MU, right? So and that makes sense, because, you know, again, someone who owned a comic book store, you know, you get these fans that, you know, are excited by the movies or the TV shows or the video games, and they come into your comic book store because they want to continue that experience. You need to have something available for them. right? Yeah. And so that makes a lot of sense. But I'm just curious, is it as simple as that, or was there, were there more editorial reasons to have both Steve and Sam as Cap at the same time?
I think a big part of it is, and I think the version sometimes people, you know, create is that, oh, the, you know, the MCU is telling them what to do, which is really not the case. Like a lot of times it's, oh, there's a movie coming. Like, how can we, the comics division, draft off that and have an excuse to make a really great Sam Cap book, which was kind of just, you know, that was kind of how it went, was it was like, can we take another run at this now that this door has been opened? And, you know, the answer was like, yeah, we're absolutely going to take another run at this now that the door has been opened. So that was a big part of it. But yeah, I think a lot of it is what you said, where it's like, you know, you want to have something on the shelves for the newer fans. Like, so much of what makes Marvel successful when it's at its most successful is its ability to bring new people in, which, you know, is what I was talking about, Runaways and the Ultimate Universe. So I think the, you know, you want to be welcoming while still also, you know, surprising people, which is something I feel very strongly about. Like one of my agendas with both of these is always, what can't they do in the movies that we can do?
I love that.
So, you know, they didn't really get an opportunity to show a lot of like Bucky with Steve after, you know, Bucky broke his brainwashing. So immediately to Jackson and Colin, I was like, can we have Bucky in this very heavily? Like, can we make this kind of a story about the two of them? And they were enthusiastically on board for that. You know, with Tochi, like Tochi came up with this, but I'm very delighted by it that he chose White Wolf as the main villain. Because that's obviously a character they can't really introduce in the movies now because they gave that name to Bucky. But mm-hmm. that means that's something that we can do, that comics readers can come to the comic and they haven't seen it before. So that's always like chief on my mind is like, you know, they didn't get a chance to show both Sam and Steve as Cap at the same time. A lot of it is less following the MCU and more being like, what cool tricks can we do that they can't do right now? Not out of spite, obviously, but just out of like, what do people want to see that they didn't get from the other thing?
Yeah, that's music to comic book readers' ears, right? I mean, like, we really want to see that. Yeah. And because, you know, most of us love the MCU, mm-hmm. but our first love is comics, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're loyal to that and want to see these fun stories that you're coming up with. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you talked about how these writers, you know, had so much fun writing mm-hmm. Zero together and that they're so far in advance mm-hmm. as far as the series is concerned. Is it safe to say that these writers will work on something for crossovers, stories or something like that in the future?
I hope so. I can't say too much yet, but obviously when you have writers that like each other that much, which doesn't always happen on, you know, shared projects, you kind of want to take advantage of it as your first impulse. So can't say anything yet, but hopefully so.
Okay. Well, all right. We'll have to have them back on the show then. All right.
Yeah.
Ooh, all right. Good. I love cliffhangers. All right. So, you know, right around the time of Nick Spencer's Secret Empire run, we had, I think, Captain America, Steve Rogers, and mm-hmm. Captain America, Sam Wilson series, which were, you know, I mean, titles were very clear and explicit what you were going to get. But this time we get the Captain America Symbol of Truth and mm-hmm. Captain America Sentinel of Liberty. Mm-hmm. So where did those titles come from? Were they suggested by the writers or the editors or someplace else?
So that was a very long process, actually. It was one of those things where I don't want to say it was focus group to death, but it was close, which is not to say I'm unhappy with where we ended up. I'm actually very happy with where we ended up. I like the titles a lot, but there was a lot of stuff thrown out that one person didn't like, or that, like, at one point we were going to do adjectives, like, you know, legendary Captain America and iconic Captain America, just because I was like, we haven't really done an adjective Captain America before. That would be fun. But then, you know, there are technical concerns, like then it's not in the right place on the order form. It's not in C. So it's like, you kind of go back and you're like, okay, what would be in C? At one point it was almost Captain America Stars and Stripes, but they kind of looked terrible in isolation, like Captain America Stars, Captain America Stripes. There were a lot of things kicked back and forth. And then I think, I don't even remember at this point, it was such a long discussion. I don't remember who came up with these specifically, but I think when we got to these, it was a pretty like unanimous decision of like, okay, this feels right. Like this feels those are books titles I can see on a comic stand. Mm. And part of the reason to not return to Cap Steve Rogers, Cap Stan Wilson is we already did that once. Right. You know, we kind of wanted to do something new here. So I'm happy with what we came up with. And I feel like I like what each title says about each character. Like I think of Sam as a truth teller, you know, more so than like Steve is not untruthful, obviously, but I think Sam has such a clear-eyed way of looking at the world that that felt right. And, you know, Sentinel of Liberty has some classic history, so that also felt right. So it was a long involved process. Yeah. And I was a little worried at one point that we were going to be stuck with something that I just hated, but fortunately that didn't happen and things kind of went our way. So yeah.
I love hearing the outtakes of what didn't make the cut.
Well, we did, if you notice, we actually did keep the Stars and Stripes motif. So Sentinel mm-hmm. of Liberty has stars in its logo and
that's right.
Symbol of Truth yeah. has stripes. So we kept that. And then the Cap Zero logo had both. So we kind of mm-hmm. used that as the visual distinction.
You know what? I saw the other, but I didn't notice that they both for Zero had both. Right. That's good catch. And then, you know, of course, the writers had fun, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, you should be Spectacular yeah. Cap and you should be Uncanny Cap, mm-hmm. you know? So that was a good poke.
And I think that was born out of a discussion where they started riffing on that joke before I had to tell them like, oh, they don't want to do adjectives. And they were like, we can still do the adjective bit, right? And I was like, yeah, I mean, yeah, do the adjective bit. It's delightful. So it was kind of a little in joke also to the process of naming the books.
All right. So I told you we would get to the legacy question. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because again, a lot of our listeners are old school. And when I say that, I mean 40 and older. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so
Rick's being generous.
So the end of the Coates run, issue 30 was known as legacy number 734. Mm-hmm. Will either of the new series have legacy numbering? Mm-hmm. And will we see the legacy numbering come back with issue 750 as like an anniversary issue? And if so, which of the two series would have that special honor?
Yeah. So the answer is yes. Technically, Cap Zero was 735. I think it didn't make it on the cover because of a communication error, honestly. And the legacy numbering in this case, like ideal situation, we would love for it to bounce between the titles, but because of on sale shifts, especially in like the current era of, you know, pandemic disruptions, it's too difficult to track between series, especially if some move or jump back or jump forward. So it is just going to be on one series and it's going to be on Symbol of Truth. So it wasn't on the first issue, but starting with issue 2, it will have legacy numbering.
That's interesting. So mm-hmm. they're going with the Sam series instead of Steve. Why mm-hmm. do you think?
That was partly a piece of Tom advice. You know, I think part of it is, you know, Steve is such a dominant force as a Captain America. Like, we mm-hmm. want to see the Sam book succeed. And we also, you know, want to signal to people that it's not a skippable Cap book. It's like a legit Cap book. So that was a big part of the decision. So that's the main thrust of it, honestly.
And I've actually seen, I mean, I don't know if this is legit or not, but I use Marvel fandom a lot, and I've seen the Sentinel of Liberty book be described as volume 2 of Captain America's Sentinel of Liberty.
Oh yeah. I think there was one point, like a lot of these discussions are still happening. I think there was one point where they asked us if we wanted to do Sentinel of Liberty legacy numbering. And it's one of those things where like it the number felt so like small in comparison that it yeah. almost felt like is it worth it? Like, yeah. And is it really connected super directly to that series? So it was definitely something we considered, but ultimately, at least at this current moment, didn't decide to do.
Mm, yeah.
So yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I've been impressed so far with the Marvel's Infinity Comics line. Mm-hmm. So that digital only series issued through Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah.
And the 4-part Captain America Liberty story arc that came out last September, I thought was really, really great. But what differences are there between editing this sort of product and mm-hmm. the traditional format?
Well, I think at least in terms of generating the story, one of my goals with that one was to not pull any punches. I wanted it to feel, you know, as legitimate a Cap story as anything else. You know, I wanted to kind of signal that, like, we can tell big important stories in this medium as well. And so, you know, a lot of the difference in the actual process was more mechanical, where it was like, that was, I think, maybe the first of the vertical comics I worked on. So it was definitely a learning curve in terms of how much space do you leave for balloons, which are bigger than usual? And mm-hmm. like how much, you know, how do you break pages in a way that the coloring doesn't suddenly look weird when it transitions into a new screen? Because they're done in these big, long strips. And it was also figuring out, like, you have to use a little less dialogue because there's not as much room to pack a page. So they have to be a little sparser and they have to move a little faster. And so, you know, a lot of those things we kind of took into consideration as we were working on it and kind of learned as we went. You know, I'm still working on them now and I feel like I've got a much better handle now on how these work. But I think a lot of those early days were saved by Nico Leone on art, just really mm-hmm. kind of embraced it and, you know, went for it in the best way. So I was grateful to have him on that series because I think he helped us out a lot. So, yeah.
I thought that story was, at least from my perspective, I thought it was a little edgier, a little more potentially controversial.
Yeah.
Does that medium, like, allow for a little bit more, maybe bolder risk-taking when it comes to telling stories, do you think?
I don't think bolder necessarily. I think that one was kind of a special case where, you know, to be perfectly honest, like, the story was pitched and underway before certain events that it seems to be paralleling happened. I know that sounds absurd, but that's like, it wasn't based on anything. It came first. And so then there was kind of a minor flurry to decide, like, what do we do here? And, you know, I think to Marvel's credit, they like pretty much let us stay the course and tell the story we originally wanted to tell. And I think Jay Edidin did a great job with it. You know, I think he really tapped into, you know, just a really good, like, kind of bottle episode for Cap that, spoke to a lot in a short amount of time. So I don't think it's the format necessarily. I think it was just with that specific one, it was a confluence of circumstances and, thankfully the support of editorial. So yeah.
Yeah. Good plug though for Marvel Unlimited, because mm-hmm. of that new content that you get there, you can't get anywhere else. Those are some pretty fun stories.
Yeah.
So when we had Tom on the show, we talked about the importance of diversifying the roster of characters in the Marvel universe, both comics and cinematic. And this way, so kids and adults, you know, see folks just like them in the comics. And this was a great conversation. And can you share your thoughts about why this is important at Marvel? And what do you say to readers who are like, oh, they're just pandering?
I mean, I think that's always a very funny complaint to me because I think comics is one of the most, like, carnival huckster businesses there is, you know, to its benefit. Like, I think if you told Stan Lee in, like, the early days of Marvel that he was pandering, he'd be like, of course I am. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I want people to buy the books. So that's one thing I always find a bit funny in a sort of abstract way of like, yeah, we want people to buy the books, but also, like, you know, to speak to the greater purpose here, it's Marvel has a core ethos of it's supposed to depict the world outside our window. And the world outside our window is not just a bunch of white dudes. And, you know, that was one of our core, you know, concepts going into the United States of Cap mini we did was who gets to be Captain America. And also, like, more interestingly, like, what does it mean for, you know, people of other races and sexualities to be Captain America? Like, because I think, to me, there's something very interesting about someone who would take on the mantle of a country that hasn't always been kind to them. And, you know, what that means to that person and how they, who they protect, what they go about doing. And we got to work with a really great group of diverse creators for that series. And I think really it's just, it's a very powerful thing to be able to see yourself in fiction and to, you know, understand that, like, you're not a side character and you're not relegated to being a love interest or a background player. And, you know, like when Bendis created Ironheart, it was partly because he wanted an Iron Man character that looked like his daughters, that they could look up to and that they could say, like, oh, this person is like me. So a lot of it is, you know, comes from a place of wanting people to feel seen through our books, because it's, you know, I'm not of a whole bunch of, like, marginalized identities, obviously, but I remember reading Runaways as a kid and all of my friends compared me to Molly. Like, cause I was very, like, I was the small friend. I was very, like, you know, kind of immature and naive and, you know, the baby friend of the group. And I don't know, it, like, felt really nice to be able to read a book where another character was kind of the baby friend of the group. And again, that's a very specific, you know, facet of identity. But I look at smaller cases like that, and I'm like, that felt great to read a book where I felt like I had something in common with a character. So I think that's a big part of it. And I think the people who get to have those experiences shouldn't always be the same group of people. And I think it's good for, you know, a dominant group of people to have an experience of learning to relate to someone who is not like them as well.
Yeah, you brought up some great points. Yeah. Like that last line you just said, it allows people to see things, right? I once heard somebody said, some of the most empathetic people in the world are people who read a mm-hmm. lot of fiction. Mm-hmm. Because by just mere, you know, act of putting yourself in the mind and thoughts of other people, mm-hmm. you know, you get to see things from other perspectives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think that goes for comics, you know, just as well. Mm-hmm. you know, and, but what do you say, you know, to those who, I don't want to, you know, rehash the topic, but it seems like another thing that people just need to learn is it's okay. There's other issues. You don't have to read every single series. You don't have to read every single title. They're not all for you. You can read the ones that you like and let people like the ones that they like.
Yeah. And it's one of those things too, where I feel like a lot of people make those decisions kind of sight unseen. Like, people were worked up about Jane Foster Thor, but that run was also a really, really good Thor Odinson story. Like, he was not absent from the book. Like, he was very much in it, doing interesting, compelling things. And, you know, the same could be said of Sam's first run, where, you know, when Nick Spencer took over, Steve was kind of this older, like S.H.I.E.L.D. agent figure who was kind of not on the same page as Sam and was kind of on his own path. You know, so I think people get it in their head that they're like, their favorite things are being taken away. And a lot of times, I think if they actually read the books, they would find that that's not often the case. Like, you know, I think even in Iron Fist right now, Danny Rand is still in the book. It's one of those things where I just sometimes feel like if people would open themselves up to change, they'd be a lot happier. But also, back issues are wonderful, and there's so many of them. So it's right. Like, you know, if it's not your cup of tea, I don't think anyone should force themselves. Like, I think there's an incredibly rich history for all of these characters, and a lot of it is more available than it's ever been. So I just, you know, it's one of those things where don't force yourself to read a book you don't like, but also keep an open mind.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I want to plumb this a bit more because I read in an interview, I can't remember where, but I read that you fell in love with The Hobbit when you were very young. And the impact of that story that had a really positive impact on your self-image. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, can you tell us a little bit about how that's impacted your perspective on storytelling?
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, I was literally the smallest person, like in my entire elementary school, there was no one shorter than me. And I was very, very shy. And I was afraid of literally everything, like actual terror of like everything. And so when I first encountered The Hobbit, it was like the first time where like, it was this tiny protagonist who just kind of wanted to stay home and be comfortable. And who was also afraid of everything. But also like through the course of the story kind of becomes the main driver who like saves all these other dudes and like helps them finish their mission. And it was one of those things that I read at such like an impressionable age that I just like fully latched onto it. Like I, you know, I wanted to be a hobbit. I wanted to have like furry feet and like not have to wear shoes. Like,
you just wanted a second, third breakfast, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I mean, that's also a big plus of the hobbit life. But I think, you know, it's also just, it's just the best book. Like it's so charming and it's so fun. And it's just like, I think I'll go on a little soapbox for a second. I think one of the things the movies got super wrong was they decided to make the dwarves cool. And I think when you make the dwarves cool, you lose Bilbo as the driver of the story, because the whole point is he runs into a bunch of protagonists and then slowly becomes the protagonist instead of them. And is just dragging them to their destination. So anyways, that's my Hobbit film soapbox. But yeah, so, you know, that ties into a lot of my feelings about why representation is so worth doing, is because I didn't even have words when I was a kid to say, like, I feel represented. I didn't know what that meant. Like, it was the 90s. Like, I don't know. But that is what it was. And it made me kind of a braver and, you know, less timid person, and it drove me to kind of, at least in small ways, try to both accept the person that I was and push myself to be better. So I think that's, you know, that's the kind of experience that you really want people to have when they're reading your books. And a lot of times that means diversifying the cast so that mm-hmm. more people can have that experience.
You also, you know, earlier when we talked about how you first got into comics, you mentioned manga, and mm-hmm. I know that Marvel experimented with manga back in mm-hmm. the early 2000s. Can we expect maybe Marvel will venture into that format again in the future?
I super hope so, because I would love to work on a manga properly. But I will say, like, even without foraying directly into it, at least in the past few years, people have been a lot more open to artists with manga styles. Like I think Federico Vincentini on Falcon and Winter Soldier, he's not a manga artist, but a lot of those influences come through in the way he draws motion and the way he draws action. You know, I was able to work with Jody Nishijima on the Hulkling and Wiccan vertical comic for Marvel Unlimited, and she has a much more manga style. She also did a US of Cap story for us. And, you know, we obviously work with Guruhiro a lot, and they have manga roots. So it's one of those things where, like, I have a very strong preference towards artists who are more manga influenced. So I think it's easy to tell on some of the projects I work on what artists I'm gravitating towards. And there are also a lot more manga artists who have been reaching out to us looking to do Marvel work. You know, I got to work with Kemome Shirahama, who is an incredible, incredible manga artist, right before she blew up big and, you know, has to work on her own thing now. But there's a lot more crossover than there used to be. And I think there's a lot more modern manga styles that fit into what we're doing in a smoother way. So I definitely am on a mission to bring more of those artists in. It's a sensibility that fortunately the people who have to approve those decisions share.
So Alana, when we were talking to Tom, it was shortly after the Marvel's Falcon and Winter Soldier show on Disney Plus. And, you know, there was this huge surge of renewed interest in the character of Isaiah Bradley. Mm-hmm. And that was for those who may not be familiar, that's the Black Captain America that appeared in the miniseries Truth, Red, White, and Black, came out in 2003. So we asked Tom if Marvel might respond to that enthusiasm with some future stories featuring Isaiah. And he was a little noncommittal at the time, and just curious if there's any updates or whether or not we might see Bradley in the future.
I don't have any concrete updates at the moment. I can say that it's a character that our Cap writers are very interested in, along with Eli. But a lot of the plans are very abstract beyond the first arc of each book. So there's really not much I can update beyond that. But I would, it's something I would like to see eventually. So.
Yes. I'm putting in my plug right now.
So what you're saying is there's a chance.
Oh, Rick. So, Alana, I hear a lot of, not a lot, but certainly some older readers complaining about the quality of Marvel talent these days, right? And I think, we grew up on certain things, right? Different generations, different ages. We have our favorite artists that we loved as kids, and it's hard. We compare everything to them, but, and it's like nothing can ever compare to like who was drawing Cap when I was a kid. But I figure, they must not be paying attention, because I've seen some pretty amazing art over the last several years from younger artists, especially in some of the Cap-related series. You've mentioned a few of them, Federico Vincentini, Mattea De Lulis, R.B. Silva, and of course, Carmen Canera. What do you think? I mean, who do you think is really knocking it out of the park these days, and who should we be looking out for?
I think obviously all the ones you've mentioned are ones that I like very much. I think one that people should really keep an eye on, honestly, is Carlos Magno, who drew the Kang miniseries that I did with Colin and Jackson before they moved on to Cap. And just the dedication that guy has is unreal, like unreal. There were pages in the scripts that Jackson and Colin were sending them that I was worried were undrawable. Like, they had a billion panels, huge amounts of dialogue, a gajillion things going on, because those guys are nothing if not ambitious. But Carlos would meet them every single time and just turned in these like just incredible mind-boggling pages with more detail than I think I've ever seen on a comics page. And he's so fast. I'm like, how are you doing this like the whole time? Like, he will hit every deadline. He's a speed demon, but he skimps on absolutely nothing. So I think he's on the new run of Savage Avengers at this point, which I think is a really cool fit for him. Unfortunately, I'm not working on that, so I don't get to work with him right now, but he's just incredible and so just up for anything that he's an amazing collaborator, and his art is just like getting better with each page. He's next level. So he's one. You mentioned Federico Vincentini. I think Federico is incredible. He's one of my favorite artists to read, just because there's so much movement in his pages and it's so visceral. I can't stand a page where it feels like someone's punching like so slowly or like not really like making contact in any way. You feel the hits in his pages, and it's incredible. Another that I should call out is I think Nico Leone leveled up in an absolutely insane way on the Winter Soldier Devil's Reign single issue that we did. I had never seen him draw like that, before. He did a run of he did Ms. Marvel for a while, and then he did Power Pack. So he was kind of typecast on a lot of these, younger characters, like a little more light stylized art. And so I kind of looked at that and I was like, what if I cast him completely against type and had him do like a weird like insomnia noir story with Bucky, mm-hmm. and just his pages were unreal on that whole issue. And it was just, it was one of those things where you could see a new level unlocking in real time with this dude. Like it was just, it was magical. So I think last I knew, I think he was on Catwoman. You know, may bounce back to us hopefully. But yeah, I think he's just leveling up every time he does something new.
I think we're going to need to see him on an Isaiah Bradley Winter Soldier 1950s story.
Nailed it. Yeah. All right, Bob, you're going to get a little royalty check when that comes out. All right. Good stuff. So Alana, if you're interested, we have some questions from our listeners that have sent some in. So we'll start with Grant Ball. He's one of our longtime patrons. He asks, what is the process for choosing a creative team for a comic? And then we have another patron, Ralph Warner, who asks a similar question. He says, how does the process for a new creative team on a relaunch work, and do you put a call out for pitches? Do you personally target a few creators? Mm-hmm. Who has input besides you on which is selected, or is this purely your final decision? And then maybe you could give some examples for the two Cap series.
Sure. There's kind of two ways that it goes. There's a version where you think for a really long time and you figure out who you think can do the thing. And then you go to that person and ask, can you do the thing? And they say yes or no. And then, you know, like, that's kind of like the putting all your eggs in one basket method. And because I was trained by Tom Brevoort, that is my preferred way of doing things. Like, just because it's very direct, it gets things done more quickly. Then in other cases, you'll cast your net a little wider and think of maybe, you know, 3 to 4 writers that you think would have a take, and you go to them and be like, would you be up for, you know, taking a swing at this and showing us what you would do with it? And then if they're willing, they write up a pitch, and then you get all of those and you compare them. And for bigger launches, for smaller launches, you can kind of decide among yourselves. Like I think on a lot of Tom's books, we kind of just would take information in and decide between ourselves which ones we wanted to do. For bigger launches like Cap, there's a lot more cooks in the kitchen in terms of, you know, people like Dan Buckley weighing in, people like Joe Quesada weighing in, CB weighing in. For these specific launches, we pretty much, I think, just like Tochi was in the first category where we went to Tochi and got a pitch from him that we loved and went all in on Tochi. The process of the Steve book was a little more complicated because we started that before we knew there was going to be a Sam book. And a big part of that was after the Ta-Nehisi run, I wasn't completely sure. And we, you know, as the, like working with Tom, weren't completely sure what we wanted the new direction to be. And sometimes if you have a little more of an idea in mind, that makes it easier to just go to one specific person who you know can execute the thing. But it was kind of like, I don't need a name here, I need the biggest idea. So that's kind of the difference, is like, if you can't quite figure out just by looking at it who's going to have the biggest idea, that's when you solicit a few pitches. Jackson and Colin do not aim small. So that pitch came in and I was immediately just, you know, brain on fire. I love this. This is great. It took a long time for everyone to deliberate back and forth between the available ideas that we had, which were all great. But I think that one, it wasn't even a matter of which one was best. It was that one accomplished the goal I wanted, which was, my goal with both of these series was to try to expand out the Cap corner of the, you know, Marvel Comics universe and be able to to do a Sam book and a Steve book and maybe a Bucky book and maybe a US Agent book and maybe a Captain Carter book. Like, I think there's so many characters in Cap that people really love that I wanted to make it a destination, like, you know, place to be again, where we were able to do more spinoffs and coordinate more things. You know, just by the nature of it, Ta-Nehisi's run was very singular and very focused. And I think there's a time for that, but I also felt like because it had been that, it was time to pivot and, you know, expand out again. So the Jackson and Colin pitch felt like the way to go in that regard, where it just felt like that was the most expansive one that hit the most corners of things.
And it's good to hear. I mean, we're very excited to see where these series go. Mm-hmm. But one of the things also about Cap is, and this is from one of our listeners, Alan Kingsley, he's seen as the moral compass, mm-hmm. right, of the Marvel Universe. And so what quality does a writer need to successfully write a character who speaks and acts with that kind of authority?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think really a big thing is it's hard to put a pure cynic on Captain America. I think you need to find people who, you know, kind of see things like Cap, see things as they could be and not just as they are. And I think both Tochi and Jackson and Colin brought such an optimism and like a humanizing force to both of these characters that I immediately felt like, oh, they get it. Like, you know, we weren't able, because the previous runs of the book were so fast paced, we were never able to really build out a civilian life for Steve, for example. For like years, we don't even really know where he lives. And it was just, you know, by necessity of the stories that were being told. But with this one, one of our very specific goals was, like, can we see where he lives, please? Like, can he have like a life outside of this and like, you know, a little more of an ensemble around him? And it was one of those things where, and you know, similar for Sam, we want to very much see, like, you know, the human side of these guys while they're doing missions or outside their missions. And so that was something I looked for as well, people who really dig into character and motivation, because I think there are kind of two schools of writers, and there's schools of writers who are very plot driven, who are very into like weaving intricate, you know, plot things over here, and there are writers who are very character driven, who are focusing on the relationships and the, you know, the character drama and, you know, what they're eating for lunch that day, but not that specifically, but, you know, like, and I just, as kind of a personal preference, I'm always drawn more to the character side of things. I don't think there's anything wrong with plot heavy writers. It's just not so much my cup of tea. I like seeing characters being characters and interacting with other characters. So, for both of these books, I was specifically looking for people who I knew would like get that and do that thing. So, you know, you could see in Tochi's first issue, there's a really wonderful like personal moment with Misty Knight in the middle of mm-hmm. a big fight scene. And I think that was something he just, you know, put in himself. And I was like, yes, excellent. Like, that's exactly what I want. And Steve's book is, I can't spoil obviously, but is similar in that.
Yes, you can.
well, you can go to Jackson and Colin's Twitter, and I think they've talked a bit about it already, so I'll let them spoil it. I'll let them have the glory. But it's a lot more about Cap kind of trying to settle into a new pattern in his life, which I was very happy about. So yeah.
Well, you just I'm very excited now, right? I mean, Alana, as far as I'm concerned, you could stay the editor on Cap for a long time, because
oh, thank you.
We want to see the character of Steve and Sam and their lives, right? Like, you know, that's mm-hmm. I mean, you go back to Roger Stern days, right? Where Cap, you know, introduced you know, some neighbors and a girlfriend and
had a job.
Yeah, right. Right. And then De Mateus, you know, he took that and he ran with it, and Grunewald certainly did. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's been missing. And I'm excited to hear about that. And I'm also glad that you went with somebody who is optimistic, right? Because that by nature, I think that's Steve and to some extent, Sam. Mm-hmm. And so, so very excited about that. Mm-hmm. But by all means, I think next you should probably tell us which writers are the pessimistic ones that you're avoiding. No, I'm kidding.
I probably shouldn't name anyone.
But, yeah, no. I'm just kidding.
I enjoy work for many pessimistic writers. I just don't think that it's Cap as a thing that would bring out the best in them necessarily.
Agreed. Now you mentioned before that you wouldn't mind seeing Bucky have his own series. Mm-hmm. Joshua Van Dyne asks, would you ever consider giving Bucky's Captain America his own series? So not him as Winter Soldier, but him as Captain America.
So I will never say never, but I am very much in the camp of, I think Bucky is most interesting as the Winter Soldier, as this person who's trying to atone for, you know, what he did and what he went through. And atone isn't even always the right word, because he blames himself for a lot of stuff he had no control over. But I think he tends to be more interesting in contrast to Cap. Like, he's kind of the person who will do the things that Cap won't, and he's kind of always been that person for Steve to some degree. And I guess, like, especially with two Caps already in the field, my worry there would be, I think it kind of hobbles a bit what makes Bucky special in this trio of, you know, very interesting different characters. Again, it's not something I would never do. Like, we put him back in the Cap suit for US of Cap, which I was very excited to do. But even there, like, Christopher Cantwell, the writer, kind of portrayed him as very reluctant to do that. So it's one of those things where, like, if it was earned, like, through the story, I think it's something I would consider. But I think at the point he's at now, he's a more interesting and compelling character, being kind of this wild card in Cap's life.
Well, while we're on the topic of Bucky, Ash Barnes, who maybe you might know through Twitter.
I do. Right?
she called in. She left this message.
Hello, Rick and Bob and Alana. This is Ash Barnes. So my question for you, Alana, is surprise about Bucky. So I know that in the upcoming Steve series, specifically Sentinel of Liberty, Jackson and Colin have talked a lot about how Bucky's going to be really relevant to the story, which I'm very excited about, very glad he'll be in every issue. So my question is, what direction do you want Bucky's story to move in, moving forward in the comics? Like, what do you think is important about his story, and how do you want that to develop over time in the comics from here on out?
Cool. So I have to be a bit cagey on this one, because Bucky is obviously very, very central to Jackson and Colin's plans. But I think for me, I think Bucky is at his most interesting when, like I said, he's a bit unpredictable. And I think he's also at his most interesting when, you know, he obviously cares about Steve very much and trusts his judgment, but I think there's also a bit of him that sometimes thinks he knows better and, like, you know, is willing to, again, do the things that Cap won't. And I think the tension of them being friends with that being the status quo is so fun and interesting. So, like, it's one of those things where, at least, it, like, you know, in this initial run, one of my things that I posed to Colin and Jackson was that thing I mentioned earlier where, like, I just want to see Cap and Bucky together for a while. Like we really haven't gotten to see that much. And when we have, it's always been very fleeting, and there's not really a reason for it to be fleeting right now. Like, Bucky's not on the run anymore. Like, you know, he's not in outer space protecting us from outer space threats. Like, it's one of those things where you can finally kind of see what their relationship looks like in normal times, and also in, you know, mission times. So that was one of my big goals with the series, is to kind of really build this relationship in a way that we haven't been able to in a while, with writers who, fortunately for me, are very passionate about Bucky, which I am as well. Bucky is one of my favorite characters, so I have a very pro Bucky agenda. But he's really going to go some very, very, very interesting places in this run. And I think if you are a Bucky fan, you absolutely should read every issue and follow this closely, because they've got some really great things planned. So, yeah.
I think a lot of us are Bucky fans, so we're very excited to hear that.
Yeah.
Last question from listeners, Aaron Paul. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before about expanding the Capverse, right? So he wanted to get a little bit into that. So in particular, plans for expanding Sam's Rogues Gallery and possibly introducing new villains for Steve. Mm-hmm. And then he said, personally, he thinks John Walker is underutilized.
I agree. I really love John Walker. I think he's such a mess, and characters who are a mess are always like just A+ for me. Like, one of my favorite characters is Quicksilver, and that boy has no idea which way is up most of the time. So so I really like John Walker. You know, it's one of those things where like I will basically go as big as they let me as soon as we're underway. A lot of it obviously depends on how well the books do. So if you want to see more spinoffs, like, please buy the heck out of both of these books, because I really want to do more with all of the characters. With John Walker specifically, this is a very weird comparison to draw, but in my head, he reminds me very much of Johnny from Cobra Kai, where he's like, yeah, where he's right. like that was kind of my in to appreciating him in a weird way, where I was like, he's kind of a loser and he kind of sucks a lot of the time, but there's like a piece of him that's like really trying to do the right thing. He just doesn't always know or understand what that is. And I find characters like that very, very sympathetic, even when they're being, you know, huge problems elsewhere in the universe. And I thought the depiction of him in Falcon and Winter Soldier was also really great. That actor was phenomenal. So,
definitely. Yeah.
He was great. I think basically as many spinoffs as sales will allow me to do, I am going to try to do. So, yeah.
And any thoughts on Sam or Steve's villains?
Oh, yes. I was like, there was another part and I couldn't remember what it was. I think the big one we're building in the Sam book is White Wolf, as I mentioned, who, you know, has a lot of Black Panther Wakanda ties, obviously. And I think Tochi's kind of not reimagining him, but like reintroducing him in a really interesting way. And it also brings Sam into, confrontations with Wakanda in a very interesting way. A lot of Sam's story will be, you know, wrestling with this person who's kind of trying to draw him into this, contentious relationship with Wakanda, because what's Wakanda going to think about a dude wearing an American flag, you know? We're also looking to, you know, I always like pairing Sam with classic Cap villains in general. So that's why you see Crossbones pop up. There's other people we're considering for future arcs and future stories. And for Steve, really the villains there are almost entirely a new and strange and intriguing thing. So I can't say too much about them yet, but I think Jackson and Colin have taken them in some really, really interesting directions that expand the lore in really cool ways. So I think that's going to be a ton of fun. So, yeah,
we can't wait. So outside of Marvel, I know you also do some writing yourself, novels and plays.
Yeah.
Can you share a little taste of what you have done or what you've got working?
I'm kind of in the trying to make it as a writer struggle along with everyone else a little bit. But I've been writing novels since high school, really. I write a little, some YA, some sci-fi, some fantasy. And I wrote a play in college that's been produced a few times that was kind of a Shakespeare riff. So a lot of it is not findable yet, but hopefully eventually, just continuing to pursue it when I'm not, you know, editing a billion books at Marvel, which is sometimes a difficult balance to strike, because it's difficult to go from one very creative job to a very creative hobby.
Yeah.
So I have a website. It's www.alanawrites.com that has some more information on like my personal creative endeavors. I should clarify, I don't respond to Marvel related questions on that site. It's more for my freelance stuff. But yeah, that's a place where people can learn more if they would like to. So,
excellent. Yeah. Yeah, well, listen, with the type of persistence you had that got you into Marvel, I'm sure your writing career will at some point, take that next level as well.
Thank you. I hope so. Yeah.
And then you're also on Twitter too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm on Twitter also at Lana Writes. So WRITES, not like writes as incorrect.
Gotcha. Well, listen, this has been a real treat. We've had a lot of fun wrapping cap with you, Alana. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been super fun. I like getting to talk about Captain America this much, obviously. So.
Well, you found your peeps.
Yep.
Awesome.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking with Alana.
Yeah.
She's sharp, you know, and she mm-hmm. really has a lot of passion for what she does. And she's certainly not shy about, expressing, her thoughts and feelings and some good nuggets in there too.
Yep. And, I love the fact that, she has a vision, right? For the books, for the characters. She knows where she wants to take it. It's not just on autopilot. It's not just, sort of the inertia of the characters moving along. She knows where she wants to take these characters and their stories. And that's refreshing. I think that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we're very excited based on some of the things that she kind of shared with us. So looking forward to that. And we will be covering in two episodes, Captain America, Symbol of Truth, #1. So the Sam Wilson series. So come back for that in 2 weeks, where we will cover that first issue panel by panel. And looking forward to that. But next episode, episode 87, we will be going back to the 80s, as we do with the second Wednesday of every month. And that is exploring the Mark Gruenwald series. And this one is The Captain Part 2. We're going to cover Captain America issues 339 through 341. So we are seeing Steve Rogers as the captain, John Walker as the new Captain America, and just exploring this 24 issue story that Mark Gruenwald did back in the late 80s. And we're now just jumping into the second half of this story. So come back next episode, episode 87, for The Captain Part 2.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Well, I think that covers it for now. So if you've enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Please subscribe. Please rate and review. We appreciate all of that.
Have your friends, folks.
Exactly. Well, he's Bob Lucius. I'm Rick Verbanis, and you have been listening to another episode of the Captain America Comic Book Fans Podcast. We'll be right back.